Hello, Rohan.
Hey, Will.
How you doing?
Yeah, good, thank you. Very good. How's everything?
Yeah, going well, going well. I've been doing a lot of looking at the Cambridge website this week.
Oh, I wonder why.
Which has made a change. I'm sure you've become acquainted with the Oxford website as well.
Yeah, yeah. It pains me, but it's for a good cause.
Now, completely unbiased, who has the better website?
Ooh, that is a good question. Completely unbiased.
It's tricky.
The Cambridge website seems a lot more text-based, doesn't it, generally, than the Oxford website?
I find the Oxford one sort of a bit easier to sort of navigate. But the Cambridge's one, I think, is a bit more, artistically presented. Like, if you look at the homepage, for example.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'm
yeah, I mean that should be another episode.
That's a whole 30-40 minute discussion, yeah, right there. So let's not.
I was quite surprised by how similar they are, I think, more than anything. Mm. I thought they'd be more different than they are, but they are broadly on the same peg.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, today's a very interesting episode. So it's one of these time capsules, which is if we could go back in time and do something differently, or tell our 17-year-old something differently, what would we do?
Yeah.
And today's all about where life could have led us if we'd, instead of applying to our original subjects, if we'd gone down different paths.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. So Rohan and I have ranked our top degrees that we would have studied. Have we not studied what we did study? And in order to sort of make sure that we don't just sort of say something very similar to what we did study, we've both picked the other university, which is why we've been browsing their websites. And I think we're going to sort of go through what we potentially could have studied. Do you want to kick things off, Rohan, or shall I go on with mine?
Let's get cracking. So I guess starting in kind of ascending order, so the third most likely subject I would have studied at Oxford. So this is relatively difficult because the one I came up with is computer science.
Okay.
Now, the reason for this is if I'd known back then how important programming and computing coding would have been and is now, then I think that would have just been a no-brainer.
Yeah.
The trouble is, I don't think I would have got in for it with the experience and skills. So it's one of those that it would have been nice to study.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would have been able to actually do what I needed to. And also the course was very different back then compared to what it is now.
Yeah. And do you think you could have convinced 17-year-old Rohan to get interested in computer science? Or do you think it's something, like you said, it's sort of you should have, but maybe it would have been tricky to get you there?
Yeah, I think I probably could have convinced myself. I mean, I thought I was quite good at computing, whatever that means.
Yeah.
But actually, on reflection, like the closest I got in terms of, again, it depends on how you define this, but like my pinnacle of my achievements were probably like replacing the hard disk in my computer and almost building my own computer. You know, I'd say that's more.
That's pretty good.
Well, you know, it's okay, right? Like, but it's not it's not Oxford. I mean, I don't know what Oxford is or computer science, but typically when I speak to Oxford's computer science applicants, they're like savants of maths. They've done all sorts of websites. They've created websites from scratch. They know Python and Java and HTML and CSS. Like, I didn't even know what those things meant back then. Mm. But I like the concept. I like the idea that actually, you know, essentially the degree is not, and then Chomsky's often say this, it's, I don't know if you had any computer science friends, but the ones at Cambridge would often say that they weren't actually that particularly good at computers. It was like they were good at like problem solving and mathematics.
Interesting, yeah.
Rather than actually like, how do I get rid of this virus from my friend's computer, which is often what I would like go to them for.
Yeah. You carry on.
No, and then often that's what they, you know, that's what they perceive to be good at, but then they, what they're learning are skills, which is essentially why they're so employable and, you know, in demand, like later on after graduation, right?
But is it, I mean, are they employable afterwards because their skills are transferable? Is it, or is it because sort of coding is so important to pretty much everything now?
Yeah, I don't know how much. So I think coding is just, I don't know how much they actually learn about coding itself. My understanding of having gone through the, you know, the course structure,
yeah,
is that they learn about the principles, like they learn about like algorithms and compilers, yeah, and computational models and databases. It's unclear as to, I mean, I can't really tell from the website whether they actually learn like Java and CSS, for instance. Like it seems like, as with most of these courses, it's all about the theories, you know, learning about game theory and how to prove things, security systems,
yeah,
probability and computing, which I think it definitely would be useful. But it seems to be like it's more creating systems and processes and learning like architecture and the principles rather than actually doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think it's, I'm always very envious of the people who do have that background, because it sort of comes, those kind of things come to them quite quickly.
Yeah.
Whereas it, and like we said, you know, you even if you want to avoid coding,
yeah,
if you want to work in science, you can't really avoid coding. And also, you know, if you want to work in a, you know, run a business or a company, chances are you're going to end up, if not you, but someone you employ, or, you know, some problems in your company are going to have to be solved by it, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'd love the idea of doing a computer science degree and then being like a, well, the listeners don't know who Gergo is, but being like a Gergo. for those of you who don't know, Gergo is like the web magician that makes everything run in our business.
Yeah.
Literally, I mean, I can't think of a single time when I said, Gergo, can you do this? And he's like, yes. it's never no. It's like, and I'm like, how long will it take? You know, I think it'll take him weeks. And it's often like, maybe 2 hours.
So, yeah. It's really impressive what he can do.
Yeah, it's just crazy, right? Like, it feels at times like magic, which is, you know, what like advanced tech does feel like when it's so sufficiently far in advance that it is magic.
Yeah, I can't remember. There's an author who says something along those lines, isn't there? Yeah. I don't know who it is because I don't read enough books, but yeah.
You definitely don't say that in your interview. And depending on which subject you're coming up with. So yeah, that was the kind of premise of computer science, is the fact that I think it would be immensely useful. I'll put it down third because I just, you know, I'd love to do it. I mean, I'd love to do it now.
Yeah.
But one, I don't think my mathematics would be strong enough to get me in back then. Two, it's actually really competitive. I think, you know, it's grown quite a bit. It's like about 40, 50 students now. But back then, I think it was almost half that.
Mm.
So it's, you know, it is fiercely competitive. So they do need to be like really, really on point.
Yeah, I think after E&M, either computer science at one of them is the next most competitive.
Yeah, or PPE. But yeah, I think PPE is a much bigger cohort, at least.
Sure, yeah.
The idea of being able to come out of a course, have a deep understanding of systems, a better understanding of problem solving, and then being set up for a life. You know, I think that was quite appealing.
Yeah.
Whether I got to get in or not, that's, I think, a different story.
Yeah, I think we can, that sort of limiting factor we can ignore for the sake of this hypothetical exercise. I think definitely one of mine I don't think I would have gotten in for at all. But
this is an interesting question, though, because there's this book which I read when I applied to university. It was called Oxbridge, The Real Rules or something.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, like back on reflection, it was filled with like very, very generic advice, but like it's still like reasonably helpful because it was, you know, unlike now, there were like almost no books available on the matter.
Mm.
There was a really interesting chapter in it where it said that there is a way for you to just, you know, apply to do the course that you're most likely to get into.
Yeah.
And just change your course when you're there.
Yeah.
Which actually I've heard of examples of. I mean, I don't know if they did it simply as a tactic, but it's precedented.
Yeah.
It doesn't work for is medicine, but that's because it's quotas. It wasn't even I read that sentence, I was like, wow, let's not even bother. Move on, next chapter.
Yeah, you get in for English Lit and then just sneakily swap over in the first week. Times,
So let's imagine that could have been a tactic.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I know people who did that, but I think also, whilst there will be a few people who are doing that sneakily, there are people who just sort of change. It's a, you know, a year between you applying and you starting. That is time for you to sort of have shifted your interest slightly. And I think you do have to do a bit of a, you have to shift from a subject which is kind of related to the next one rather than two completely unrelated subjects.
Yeah, I think there'd probably be questions raised if you chose to switch from like classics to engineering, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Then again, if you had the credentials, then it's possible. This was actually really like popular when in a long time ago now, Cambridge used to, if you were a medic, you used to be able to do any subject you wanted for your third year, was the kind of theory.
Wow. Like,
yeah, so it was cool, right? Like you could do law, you could do HSPS, you could do geography, you could do pharmacology, biochemistry, which a lot of people do.
Yeah.
But if you wanted to do something more left field, i.e. in the humanities, then it wasn't, in theory, it was possible. In practice, it was actually quite difficult because you had to essentially have an interview with the director of studies in that subject, and they would ask you very, you know, challenging questions.
Yeah.
And if you just didn't know them, the, you know, which, you know, is reasonable for you not to know them, given that you were not studying them or have an interest in it. So there weren't that many instances where people did branch out sufficiently. I mean, there was one chap who did law that I know of, one chap who wanted to do geography, which was denied.
Mm.
So it is tricky.
Okay.
Just on that note, actually, I'm aware I'm getting on a tangent here slightly, but although it's possible to change courses, it's also possible to change colleges in very small certain criteria, which I don't know if Oxford did this, but someone actually moved to, there's a college next to our, to my old college, Keys. There was another college called King's. And King's is like the big chapel that you often see in the photos of Cambridge next to the river with the punts. And as you can imagine, it's really, really heavily touristy. And there was a chap there who was essentially just, you know, borderline autistic, just hated being around like the high level of like volume of people.
Right.
So they let him switch to Keys in his first term, which I thought was quite a nice gesture.
Yeah, I was going to say, I wasn't sure what you were going to say the switch was for, but I was going to say, I think at Oxford for like pastoral well-being reasons you could. But beyond that, I hadn't heard of it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, okay, so computer science, that would have been third most likely.
Yeah, right. What about you?
So I've put, my third is history and politics at Cambridge.
Okay.
And as I was going through my subjects, I thought actually, whilst this obviously showcases some of the different subjects at Oxford and Cambridge, really it sort of showcases what you and I are interested in, slash I think, you know, think is worth doing, right?
Yeah.
And I've always, so I was quite close to applying for history. For a while, I was sort of undecided between doing history or psychology.
Right.
And obviously, you know, went for psychology in the end, but history was a serious contender. And I sort of see history and politics as like a very good combination. I did history as a pre-U and did a lot actually of 19th century British politics. That was basically one half of my whole 2 years of history. And I really enjoyed it. So when I was looking through the different subjects at Cambridge, this wasn't immediately third, but I actually thought this would be a relatively easy one for 16, 17 year old Will to sort of think, yeah, let's do it. But two, you know, it's like a good combination of subjects to then go into something, I don't know, sort of like civil service-y or sort of that kind of thing. So I guess similar to the computer science, sort of looking at what you can do with it, but also thinking, would I have enjoyed it? And like the course itself actually offers quite a lot of range of stuff to be able to pick from. And I think that was something that I was really keen on. I was keen on being able to pick modules and things like that.
Yeah, it's quite broad subject as well, isn't it? Like it's not tied down to one stream, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. And as far as I can tell, you can kind of, you can skew how much of each you want to do as you get further into the degree. So if you're really enjoying the politics side of things, you can sort of do more of that. And I think particularly in your third year, you've got quite a quite a big range of topics that you can go through. So that's quite, you know, would have been quite appealing to me at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Do you think is that the one you think you wouldn't have got into? I think you have a good chance.
I think I could have. Well, it's difficult, right? Because it would have been a very different, you know, kind of interview, presumably.
Yeah.
I feel like I could have. I did okay in my history. I got a D3, which is technically only an A.
Yeah.
But you know, the pre-U's pretty tricky.
Right.
But I feel like I could have, you know, interviewed and sort of argued my case pretty well with what I knew and what I'd been learning about and what I've been reading about. I mean, one thing that I did, that you do like a mini dissertation with the pre-U. So I did a dissertation on the Russian Revolution.
Okay.
And that was quite fun because you're sort of working with going through like primary sources and things like that. And I think I could have definitely talked about that at the interview and sort of impressed. I thought it was a really good dissertation. I think my mark was all right in it, but I thought it was great.
The best piece of work ever.
Step aside, experts of the Russian Revolution.
Based on what's happening in the world right now, whether you probably would have leaned towards that subject more than psychology.
Potentially. You know? Yeah. If it was happening now, it could be me that BBC were interviewing to get an understanding of, you know, what these sort of Russian-Ukrainian tensions.
What is Putin thinking, especially if he did a master's in psychology at the same time?
Oh, yeah. I was so qualified for that. So, yeah, I mean, what?
I can imagine the documentary now be like, inside the head of Putin.
I'd always really like, so I really enjoyed history at school as well. And I'd always really enjoyed those like history documentaries where a historian's sort of walking through a field, you know, moving their hands quite expressively and talking about, I definitely saw that I could be one of those.
Yeah.
What could have been, huh?
What you need to do is just age yourself like 20 years very quickly. And then like
definitely
carry a lot more gravitas and just walking around. And you need a cape or a gown, as they call it in Oxford.
So. A gown. Wait, you actually called them capes?
No, I say in Oxford and Cambridge they're called
gowns. Oh, okay. I thought in Cambridge they called them capes, like superheroes.
Yeah, like that, don your cape.
Wow. Well, if they'd have done that, I definitely might have applied.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's my number three. We're now getting up to number two on the list. What have you got?
So number two was interesting for me because you might think this is a bit of a fudge.
Right.
Is
it medicine?
No, it's not medicine, but it's something similar. But actually, it sounds similar. It's actually quite different.
Okay.
Which is human sciences.
Okay.
Now, I had a broad understanding that human sciences, you know, it was actually about biology and, you know, physiology, etc. Like I knew we'd still cover evolution, ecology and all this stuff. But I didn't realize to what extent there was humanities kind of stream to it.
Yeah.
I think like my issue with the humanities, I loved like, you know, geography, history, for instance, but it was just, it felt quite difficult to relate to when it's stuff like demographics, population, anthropology, sociology, that feels a lot more relatable. And I think that I would have enjoyed a lot more. And actually, the course is still quite similar to medicine. Like you do like the heavy lifting in your first 2 years, and the third year is kind of you do a dissertation followed by a couple of like modules, which are like special options, essentially.
Yeah.
I think that would have been quite interesting. So, and depending on, because I can see a scenario where actually, because this all depends on your teachers, right? Ultimately, like we all end up getting better at things that we enjoy because we enjoy them and therefore get better at them, or we're better at them because we enjoy it, and so on.
Yeah.
So, and a lot of that's determined by our environment, who we end up. So I can imagine a situation where I go into this course to keep my options open. I like the sciences, I like the humanities, and actually I love the humanitarian element and end up specializing in that instead in my third year. Like I could see that happening fairly easily. Or actually that, and I think this is a shame that people don't make a bigger deal of this, is loads of people go into medicine just thinking because that's like a default. I like helping people. I like science.
Mm.
But very few people seem to know about this course, which is people and science at Oxford. And, you know, the quality teaching is naturally going to be good. And then it just allows you to subspecialize.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask, did you know about it at the time?
No, not at all. You know, I think, again, if we could have chosen the Cambridge courses, I think it would have just been biological natural sciences, physical natural sciences, yeah. Medicine.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And I almost applied to natural sciences instead because I just liked the idea of having my options open.
Yeah.
Similar to you, I like kind of keeping as many things possible rather than shutting them down.
Sure.
But this was just kind of completely broad, you know, left field. But actually, it makes a lot of sense. Again, still quite a small course, you know, only 40 students every year. But the fact that you can essentially have, you know, best of both worlds, I think is quite appealing.
Well, I think it's also quite new. I don't think it's something that's been around for that long. I mean, you know, relatively speaking, some of these have been around for a very long time.
Yeah. I think, was it History and Politics was, I can't remember, that came across, I think, in the 70s. So,
yeah.
It's just, okay, no, BA Human Science was founded in 1969. Okay.
So okay, I was totally wrong. All right, it's been around for a while.
Yeah, 60 years is enough, so 50 yeah. years.
No, that's a really good choice, actually.
I think, unlike computer science, which, you know, when you were talking about your interview performance for history and
policy,
I was like, there's no way I could survive an interview on computer science. Whereas actually, you know, human sciences interview, I fancy my chances.
About. Yeah.
The test was also TSA, which is broadly just the BMAT, but extended. So yeah, I think I'd have a decent chance of that. Still a really small intake, though.
Mm.
Only 35, 40 students.
Yeah,
and the A levels would have been the same as well, biology and maths. So,
did you do any like writing A levels? Would that have been a problem? Do you think? Or,
I mean, I did in the sense that I did like this A level. I don't know if you probably didn't even know about it. It was called General Studies.
I've heard of it, but we didn't do it.
Yeah, it was infamous. I think it was just like a way from our school to get like because they got paid from the government for every like
A-level. Everyone that does it. Okay.
Yeah. Well, they got paid per A level, so they were kind of just putting all their kids through to general studies. So instead of like,
right,
doing this, like, I mean, I've got like, I literally got full marks because it came in three modules. I think I got like full marks in one of them, and then the humanities one, I got like a B, which I was like terrified. But I mean, they averaged out. I did these things called extension awards. I think I've talked about them in the past. We did do essays, but you know, they weren't the essays that, or the caliber of essays you'd write at university. Like they were much shorter, less structured. But
I suppose that in itself would indicate that you're not, you know, it's not like you haven't written an essay for 3 years. You've still been writing stuff, and that would potentially be enough for a tutor.
I guess I was so shocked that I have to write essays when I got into medical school. I
mean, yeah,
that was
yeah, just, yeah.
I thought I finally got rid of them, but.
Okay, awesome. Well, it's interesting that you mentioned natural sciences because that was my second option.
I think that's such a good course. So.
It's an amazing course, right? You know, so many students want to do it, and it's very easy to understand why, because you've got like it's such a great way to approach science, I think. Mm. You know, rather than sort of pigeonholing things into particular areas, being able to sort of develop your understanding across disciplines, so important. Yes, there are a couple modules later on which are psychology related, but you know, obviously most of the degree would be probably on the biological side of things. But again, you know, I think I was very keen on maths at the time. I could have very easily gotten interested in sort of the physics side of things. But I do think natural sciences is the one that I wouldn't have stood a chance getting in for that ski. I did maths and further maths at A level, but then I did history and psychology. So I just don't think I would have had the right kind of background to then be able to stand up in an interview.
Yeah.
I mean, I could have done a lot of work towards it, but I think at the time, firstly, it would have been hard to convince me that way. And also, yeah, it would have taken a huge amount of work. But, you know, I think it's a fantastic subject. I'm, you know, well done, Cambridge, for putting together something like that. Because obviously that must be a lot of work, right, to have the right kind of expertise to do that.
Yeah, and it's just, it's the fact that there's that breadth, I think, it's just, you know, the fact that you can go in, not really have a solid understanding of where you're going to end up specializing in, explore all these sciences, and then end up choosing one that you actually really like. You know, the option of psychology is there, but actually there's a very good chance that you may have ended up liking, I don't know, like
particle physics,
biomechanics or something, right?
Like, yeah. The range is amazing. And I think, you know, for any listeners, if you are at school and you like science, but you know, a lot of people don't know what they want to do, right?
Yeah.
And you've got to, you know, you turn 16 or 17 and now all of a sudden you've got to decide. Actually, natural sciences gives you that option to not it's effectively putting off the decision for another few years whilst you're still exploring, which is a fantastic opportunity.
But also, it's just such a broad degree and it's just so well respected. I mean, if I could do it all again, I would, again, even more strongly consider natural sciences. The only reason I ended up applying to medicine, not the only, one of the main reasons was that I could see like a route after medicine. So after completing my degree, I could see, okay, after I've done this, I'll then go into foundation training, after that, I'll go to core medical and so on. Whereas with natural sciences, it just wasn't that path. But I think to a certain extent, when I was that young, I just liked the level of certainty. Whereas now I kind of would almost embrace that level of uncertainty, which is you've got 3 years, you don't quite know what's going to happen, but it's going to be good stuff, right? Like it's not going to, you're not going to suddenly end up without a job or without like a degree. Like you're going to get through it.
Yeah.
It's going to go places.
Yeah. You're pretty employable at the end. And I think the path sort of makes itself as you go along rather than, but you know, for you, you wanted that clear path. For some people, not having a clear path is absolute deal breaker. For some people, it's fundamental. They need that. They don't want to be like, well, this is me just now signing myself off to this for the rest of my life. Like that can be quite an intimidating thing.
And, you know, that's definitely something worth saying to the listeners, which is if you are committing to a medical degree, you are committing to a medical career almost. Like there are places you can hop off, but especially now, the vast majority of people will choose to stay on. And it never really ends. Like even after medical school, you can kind of you kind of expect it, and it's almost disadvantageous for you to drop off.
Yeah,
you have to finish foundation training, and then again, it's frowned upon if you take like too many years. So it's not a bad thing, you know. Like ultimately, you've got like a very clear level of progression and natural pathway to getting and ending up in a very comfortable lifestyle. But at the same time, if you like the idea of kind of ending up in, you know, on an oil rig or in the middle of the Atacama drilling somewhere, like that level of uncertainty and optionality is only available with a much broader degree.
Yeah. Well done, Cambridge.
I can't see how I would, as a doctor, end up in, you know, ocean diving or, I mean, on an airplane, like until much later in my career.
Yeah. I mean, I think also with something like medicine, you know, given that you put 6 years into it, it's sort of like a sunk cost fallacy, right? You put so much time into it to then just sort of not even do your foundation year. It's like, well, you know, that's a lot of time to put on to not even have a few years as a doctor. Whereas if you do, you know, a 3 year degree, I suppose it's less that way a little bit.
Yeah. And when I speak to parents every now and then, now they're always just like, you left medicine, but why? Like they still like can't find it hard to compute. So yeah, it's just it's very much a cultural as much as a some cost fallacy. But so number one, having talked about how important broadness and optionality and everything is, was actually going to be physics for me.
Okay.
So I think if I could do natural sciences, that probably would have been my like number one go-to degree. But actually, I was really interested in physics. Like, I was a bit of a, still probably am, a bit of a space nerd.
Right.
So, you know, to the extent where I essentially ended up like super specializing in as much as possible in medicine, in space physiology when I was there. And the fact that you can do essentially everything in as much detail. Like natural science is great, but if you're sure and committed that you want to do physics, then actually it's less good because it still forces you.
You're still going to do some other stuff. Yeah.
So if you just love physics, and I, you know, back then I don't think I did, but I could have been very easily convinced with the right teacher to just apply to physics. And then, yeah, doing the idea of doing like things like Newtonian mechanics, mathematical models, astronomy, classical quantum physics, that is like really exciting, which I know is like, is not everyone's cup of tea, but the fact that you can create equations, which then explain the world around you, I think that's like amazing.
I do often think, because I've recently read a book, I can't remember who the author is, but it's a book sort of introducing lay people to, you know, advanced concepts in physics.
Yeah.
And I read it and I kind of think, you know, why am I wasting my time doing what I'm doing when these people are actually doing, you know, amazing stuff?
Like, there were times when I was doing like A-level physics and I would do like, I'd go like a level above and just like go and push like the bounds of what my course remit was allowing me to do.
Mm.
And every now and then I'd come up with like some kind of equations. And then you have this thrill you get, and it feels like you're almost hacking the world when you like create equations. Which then like gives you an answer in a completely different setting.
Yeah.
So it was like, I can't remember now, but it was something really simple. Like imagine a 8x8 board, like a chessboard, right?
Sure. Yeah.
And I think our coursework was really simple, which was you had to figure out how many ways there were of arranging three dots in order to get like a line. So essentially, a line is defined as three dots in a row that can be horizontal or vertical or diagonal.
Yeah.
Right? And a line is formed if you have three of them consecutively.
And straight,
yeah. So, yeah. Which sounds relatively simple. And essentially, we had to come up with an equation of defining if you change the number of sides. So if that eight goes to nine, for example, how many permutations are possible to get those number of lines across.
Mm.
Right. And that's like relatively simple. But I did that relatively quickly, like took a few hours. But then and being a nerd, I kind of ended up doing that in a not just number of, instead of doing three, I ended up changing that three to a two, to a five, to an eight.
Mm.
And then I ended up making that 3D and then I created an equation for that and a model. And like the fact was, right, like this is such a simple thing, but it had like applications, which I didn't even think of. But the fact I could create something from like my desk, which would then like essentially be able to hack this entire system.
Yeah.
It felt like I was looking into like the inner workings of the universe. And I don't think anything has excited me. As that's a very, you know, minute example, but I don't think anything quite excited me to that level. But you're right, like, you know, everything I do in my day job, I do often wonder, like, God, like, there are people out there working at such higher levels of thinking. And all I'm doing is, you know, like, just creating, yes, like, it's obviously useful to individuals. But in terms of, like, advancing the knowledge frontiers of humankind,
yeah,
I must be like a chimp to these physicists.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think I don't understand how as a physicist doing that kind of work, you wouldn't develop an ego because you literally are solving
the universe. But it's the fact that people don't respect them, which I just find astonishing. Like, there's this thing called, like, you know, people, oh, it's not brain surgery, is it?
Yeah.
It's not rocket science. Like, rocket science is relatively, like, challenging. But, like, quantum mechanics is, but brain surgery, I mean, I don't know where this, again, getting off on a slight tangent, but I don't know where this idea of like surgical precision comes from. I mean, having been in theaters, I can assure you there is no surgical precision from what I've seen.
Wow. So, very, very reassuring to hear.
Most of the time you don't need to be surgically precise, right? I mean, if you're doing ophthalmology and like burying someone's eye, then yeah. But most general surgery, like laparotomies and cholecystectomies and stuff, like it's really not that precise. It just doesn't need to be. But yeah, it's just a very different environment and ecosystem, though.
Definitely.
Both these biology and chemistry operate in a very different plane to, I think, physics.
Mm.
And that, I don't think, is acknowledged as much as it should be.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So the theoretical physicist extraordinaire you would have been had you not been doctor.
Again,
two pretty good options.
This is again, caveat to me that I don't know if I would have got into it.
Yeah, I anticipate the kind of things that come up at interview are going to be pretty tricky, right? Do you think, but you were quite interested. Do you think with a bit more effort, you could have gotten there?
I think I'd have probably had to make that decision earlier.
Sure.
It was one of those that when you commit to medicine, you start reading medical textbooks and start focusing on chemistry. Back then, the PAT, there weren't that many papers, but even now the PAT is really, really challenging.
Yeah.
I remember one of our students a couple of years ago said, when they came out of the test, they emailed us saying, I wouldn't be surprised if that was a NASA recruitment test. it's up there. I think, if I'd known straight from the offset that this is what I'm going to do,
sure,
you prepare yourself accordingly, then I think it's possible, right? But giving yourself a month at it, it's just not going to happen.
Yeah. Really tricky.
I think the potential was there. So what was your number one?
So it's quite different. It's very different, in fact. My number one is Anglo-Saxon, Norse, and Celtic.
Okay.
Now
that is really different.
It is very, very different, right? Again, this is sort of drawing on like my interest in history,
right?
And I think if I, but I also think I'm looking at this through my lens of now. Mm. I think if you told 16-year-old Will to go and study Anglo-Saxon, he'd have said no. But like, if I could go back and change his mind, I think this is what I want to, because I think, the idea of being an expert in sort of Anglo-Saxon, Norse and Celtic history really strongly appeals to me. I'd love to be able to sort of understand those languages and sort of be able to read these ancient texts,
You just want to look at a shaman, don't you?
It's not asking too much. A hood would be preferred, yeah. But I do think that whilst similarly to you with physics, I would have had to have made this decision early. I do actually think this is something that I was sort of, with what I was doing, I was gearing up to, and with what I was interested in, I was gearing up to. And so I think like could have stood a chance in an application process. I would have just really enjoyed it. I think I don't think I would have. Obviously, in terms of a career afterwards, you either become a sort of old professor in these things, or you do something completely different. But I don't think I would have cared. I think I would have been very happy to have just studied that for 3 years, and then if nothing materialized, then just moved on to something else. I don't think I would have minded too much, but. Yeah, it just seems like a fantastic. So, looking at the sort of the course outline on their website, I was thinking this is definitely stuff I would have enjoyed.
I think you'd have a pretty good chance as well. I think it's probably one of the easiest course. Again, there's no thing is easy, but it's probably one of the easier courses to get into. I think success rates are almost 50% for.
Yes, yeah, so, it would have just swan in. Yeah, I think, but I mean, you see this with. It's interesting with classics, you see that the success rate is about 50%, but also, the grade caliber is the highest in classics compared to other subjects. Yeah. I think they're just under applied to because people don't know about them. And also it's kind of in something like classics in particular is not really accessible if your school doesn't do Latin A level, for example, which a lot of schools might not. And I anticipate, there are very few. I would anticipate there are a few teachers in sixth forms and schools across the country who are really impassioned about Anglo-Saxon, Norse and Celtic, and would sort of, if they saw someone who was right for it, would be like, you should really apply to do this. Like you were saying, your teachers matter a hell of a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. I can see it. And the Aznac tripods. Actually, do you know why it's called the tripods?
No.
So Cambridge has this weird thing where all their courses are called triposes. Got the medical tripos or the natural sciences tripos, and it's a historical thing. Again, I don't know how true this is, but the story I was told is that at the end of your first year, you would get given a leg, like not a human leg, like a stool leg. At the end of your second year exams, you'd get given a second leg. And at the end of your third year, you get given the stool and the third leg. And then essentially that's the tripos. So it's like a 3-year course. The trouble is sometimes the tripos is split into something called part one and part two. So part one can be either 1 year or 2 years, and part two will typically be 1 year or 2 years.
The rest,
most courses will have 3 years, but some will have four. ASNAC's one of those ones, which is, I think part one is year one and two, and then part two is year three.
Mm-hmm.
And the significance of that is, I'm going somewhere with this. The significance of that, once you've completed a part, you can then actually transfer courses. And I think ASNAC is actually one of the ones that people transfer quite frequently from.
So you can transfer away from it.
Yeah. So often you can do something like a part one, and then in years one and two, and then you often transfer from part in your third year in part two to a part two equivalent in history or English, for example.
Right.
So again, it's one of those courses that does keep your options open.
Yeah. Do you still get the stools?
No. I didn't get mine. So if they do, I feel shortchanged.
Well, presumably you deserve two stools because you were there for so long.
Oh, it didn't count as a tripos, my second degree or third. I don't really know how it's defined, but
right.
Yeah. So it's just the first one, unfortunately, but I think it's a historical thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
We should do an episode on all these historical traditions. There's a great one I've got, which is all about how you're allowed to the invigilators at Oxbridge, or at Cambridge at least, have to bring you a meal if you ask for one during your exams.
Ah.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ask for a meal? No.
No. Didn't dare / didn't have time. So.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
Okay. So to recap, yours and mine options. So mine were computer science, human science, and then physics.
Yeah. And mine were history and politics, natural sciences, and Anglo-Saxon, Norse, and Celtic. I think if anything, it kind of shows that at these two universities, you've got a huge range of amazing things that you can study, right?
Yeah.
There's no shortage of good courses.
But also that choice is important, and what you do with, I mean, we've talked just in this short 40-minute segment, we've said multiple times that we probably wouldn't have got in for some of these courses.
Yeah.
Or we could have got in, but we'd have to take a very different level of preparation to what we've done. So you know, it shows that obviously we both got in to our respective courses, but that doesn't necessarily give us a clear pass into getting in to some of these other courses, right?
Yeah, definitely. Because, you know, and I think often you need to be choosing the course that's right for you, right? And you'll get into the one that's right for you if you're right for it.
Yeah.
You won't get into the one that's not right for you, even if you think, you know, it might be a good idea.
Yeah, I don't think I could get into ASNAC despite the best will in the world.
Yeah. Oh well. I think it's always tempting to sort of think what if, but I think at the time, obviously, we were both geared up for what we did, right?
Yeah, and you know, I think I made it pretty clear I would have applied to natural sciences at Cambridge if I could have chosen the game. Did you have a particular winner for Oxford?
Well, that I would have PPE. I know everyone says it, but it is a good combination of subjects.
Mm.
You know, it's. And I think, although I do think it's something I definitely sort of started getting interested in, certainly I would have been less interested in the philosophy, I think, but I certainly started getting more interested in politics as I got older. So I think maybe whilst I was 16, I wasn't too bothered. Nowadays, I can definitely see the value and think that I would have been quite interested in it. Mm-hmm. The rules were you can't choose from your own university, so we abided by them very well.
Yeah, well done to us. All right, well, what do we got in store for us next week?
So next week, we're going to be talking a bit about sort of how government policy affects, affects behavior and how behavior can be, impacted. And we're using the 5P plastic bag charge as a showcase of, you know, how that can be achieved.
Yeah.
And that's good. You know, I like to talk about the environment, so another opportunity to do so will be fantastic.
Just on that note, I've since you told me about that pizza box, the fact that can't be reused, I've told that to so many people and they're all horrified.
Yeah.
So if I feel like that's like the biggest like shock factor that's come out of these podcasts.
it is interesting. I mean, you know, these things do change all the time, but
yeah,
it's the fact that no one really knows. I don't know like the complete what you can and can't recycle. I don't think that the best expert in recycling will definitely know for sure. I'm sure it's just too complicated. But hey, have you got a fact for us?
You first.
Me first. All right. So mine is actually related to Anglo-Saxon, Norse, and Celtic. Okay. So I've kept it thematic. I was doing a bit of researching, and I was looking at the reign of King Ethelred the Unready.
Okay.
Now, across King Ethelred's reign, he ended up having to bribe the Vikings a lot to keep them from attacking him.
Okay.
And to quantify a lot, so it was 40, the estimates are that it was around 40 million silver pennies were paid. And so you know, I'm not talking like a 1p coin.
Yeah.
So these are sort of pure silver.
Actual
silver coins.
40 million of them.
40 million in his, and he was king for about 30 years.
Wow.
And so this is a short period of time of the Vikings attacking England, right? They did a lot of attacking outside of it. And that it's what I was reading, say it's quite difficult to quantify exactly how much that's worth, but that's about sort of anywhere above £1 billion, sort of basically to stop people attacking them.
Right.
And sort of just from doing some quick maths, they were attacked by the Vikings about 60% of the time during his reign. So it didn't do a fantastic job of keeping them away.
Yeah, how effective was it?
But the fact that comes from this is that so many silver pennies were paid to these Viking raiders that actually more Anglo-Saxon silver pennies have been found sort of in Sweden and Denmark than have been found in England. So much of it was sent that wow. they sort of expelled the coffers, basically.
Think of where England could have been if they hadn't done that. Well, probably we could have been annihilated, I suppose. So.
That's true. That's one, and I suppose that's what he was trying to avoid. But I mean, it kind of, what I was reading, some of the people who have talked about it have said, well, you know, that just goes to show how much wealth there was.
Right.
The fact that they could, and what's kind of, you know, sad to see is that it was he'd pay them, you know, a few thousand pounds like weight of silver, and then it wouldn't be like different Vikings coming back next year. It'd be the same ones. They just keep coming back.
And were they coming to collect, or were they just coming because they just felt like it?
Well, what they would do was, I think by this point they'd worked out that actually it was more valuable to raid England a little bit until you got paid rather than to actually take over and occupy. So what they would do is they would sort of land in. I mean, a couple of times they went straight to London. They just sort of sailed up the Thames, yeah, went straight into London and would attack it and sack it, and then would get paid to go away, basically. So they'd, yeah, do the attacking. It wasn't really preventative.
Yeah.
It was predominantly after
they were essentially conditioning this king to pay them every time they landed, essentially.
Yeah, and the king is conditioning them to carry on fighting,
right?
To keep attacking.
They needed an expert psychology behavioral grad.
If only.
Yeah. You have so many uses across history. So.
Absolutely, absolutely. But yeah, it's you know, we definitely have this idea of the Vikings attacked a lot, but I don't think we understand quite how much of a how much interaction we have with these people. They you know, I won't go into it. What's your fact?
Yeah. Need a new episode for that. So mine stems from, I was visiting one of our friends, and they've got a child who's, you know, really cute and 10 years old. Mm-hmm. And on his bedroom wall, he's got a diagram of the solar system. And the solar system shows the sun and then like the various planets. And what kind of triggered this thought was, in all these diagrams, the planets are always in the same plane.
Right.
You never see, like, you know, Venus half a centimeter, half a meter above, and then Mars like diagonally down. They're always like in a straight line. That's quite odd, right? Like that must be like a weird artistic license, essentially.
A simplification to say paper.
Actually, it's not. And actually, it makes sense if you think about it, because the whole solar system was formed. If you imagine like a big gas, volume of gas, and then you kind of just spin that gas around. So imagine like whirlwind, putting in a whirlwind or a mix, or a blender.
Yeah.
What you'll eventually see if your blender's wide enough is that they'll start to coalesce into a disc, or a plate, rather than actually random clumps forming in above and below.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happened with the solar system. And actually, it's not just that. So obviously, this explains why everything's rotating and everything's rotating around the sun. It also explains why everything's in the same flat plane. You know, what Marvel, they often talk about is like the uniting or the what is it? The
convergence.
The convergence, yeah. It's a thing. But what's interesting is, not only does the solar system spin, the individual planets spin, right? So we know that the Earth spins, like the Coriolis effect. But the other planets do that as well. And interestingly, pretty much all of them spin the same way, which, again, you'd expect, apart from two. So Uranus spins like 90 degrees. So it doesn't spin on its normal axis. It spins 90 degrees
on its side. Yeah.
And Venus is even stranger. Venus spins the other way.
And is that because you'd have thought if whatever is spinning everything would spin it in the same direction, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So it gets more interesting. So the moon doesn't spin, and the various celestial bodies near Venus and Uranus do spin, but they also spin in the same way. So what the leading theory is actually there were large like asteroids that hit these planets so big that actually they caused the planets to spin the other way.
The moons of these spinning the other way planets spin the same way that Earth spins.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's weird. The leading theory is Venus was spinning the normal way, i.e. the same way as all of the other planets. Then a big asteroid comes along and hits Venus, and then it causes it not just to slow down, but also spin the other way.
Yeah, imagine.
It's crazy. Imagine that explosion must have caused. And the same thing for Uranus, except it just, instead of spinning it the same way, just knocked it over.
I'm still baffled that they are genuinely on that same flat plane.
Yeah, it's crazy.
If you'd have asked me, I would have said that's probably a simplification.
Yeah, it's nuts, isn't it? Like especially in essentially a vacuum where things can just move so easily.
Yeah.
No friction. You'd expect that level of kind of movement. But the fact that they're just spinning and they were formed billions of years ago and just carried on spinning the same way
is
fascinating.
There's potentially a physics graduate who's sort of listening, thinking, these fools, it's so simple.
Yeah.
And there's also potentially an Anglo-Saxon, Norse and Celtic graduate who's thinking he's got it completely wrong.
And both of those could have been us if we'd chosen our top subjects.
If only. All right, well, I'll see you again next week. We'll talk about plastic bags. Hopefully the listeners want to hear about plastic bags.
Yeah, I hope so too. All right.
Take care. Bye.